Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising. This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Valerie Sanderson, and at 13 hours GMT on Wednesday, the 7th of August, these are our main stories. Afghan officials say 14 people have been killed and nearly 150 injured in a Taliban truck bomb attack in Kabul. Sporadic protests have broken out in Indian-administered Kashmir, despite a security lockdown imposed after Delhi revoked the region's special status. Beijing has issued its most direct warning yet that the Chinese army could be used to quell unrest in Hong Kong. Also in this podcast, we find out how to humble the scary seagull that's about to snatch your lunch. There has been no let-up in the violence in Afghanistan, despite the fact an agreement seems to be near between the US and the Taliban, which would lead to the withdrawal of American troops from the country. As peace talks continue in Doha, in Qatar, 14 people were killed in a truck bomb attack in Kabul. A fleet of ambulances ferried more than 140 injured to hospitals after the massive bomb exploded. The Taliban said they carried out the attack. From his hospital bed, this man described what happened.
It was a terrible sound that we heard, and I was wounded by flying glass that hit my hand and leg.
I spoke to our reporter in Kabul, Alia Atrafi.
This now we know was a truck bomb which caused massive devastation. The police headquarters that it targeted is so severely damaged that it's unusable now. Houses around the circumference of the attack have also been damaged. And this damage extends to hundreds of meters of housing whose windows have been shattered.
And we understand lots of the victims were women and children.
That's right. This is, although the Taliban said that the place that they attacked was a training center, but the Ministry of Interior insists that there wasn't a significant training center in the place that the Taliban had attacked, and that a lot of activities happening in this place and around the area are civilians. This was also around 9 a.m., the Kabul rush hour, and the west of Kabul is a very lively place, so that explains the massive casualties for civilians.
Alia, this attack has taken place and been claimed by the Taliban as peace talks are going on between the Taliban and the US in Doha in Qatar. Will this latest attack, will it affect anything that happens with those talks?
No, it's understood to be rather the contrary. So now you know that the Taliban said that significant progress has been made with Americans. That means in the coming months there will be some sort of face-to-face talks between the Afghan government and the Taliban. And one of the first things they will discuss there will be ceasefire. So before that ceasefire kicks in, not only the Taliban, we have to understand, but also the Afghan government. Both sides to the conflict are trying to pressurize each other and discredit each other as much as they can, because then at the peace talks they can come from a position of strength as they see it, and that will be an advantage as it's seen.
Alia Atrafi in Afghanistan. Now to Delhi, where a march has taken place with protesters calling for the restoration of communication links with Kashmir, which had its autonomy revoked by India on Monday. Here's what some of those taking part in today's demonstration had to say.
I don't think it's possible for any Kashmiri to reach out to his family. I don't have the privilege of knowing if they're alive or not. This is not integration. This is a betrayal.
If they're going to integrate us without our consent, that's not integration. That's occupation, isn't it?
Until today, there have been people who have believed in the idea of Indian democracy. They have left people who want to believe in the Indian democracy with very few straws to grab on.
The Indian-administered state of Jammu and Kashmir remains in lockdown following the announcement that the region was to be stripped of its special status. Pakistan's Prime Minister Imran Khan has vowed to fight India's decision.
I want to make it clear that we will fight on every forum. At the United Nations Security Council, we are deliberating on how we can get to the International Criminal Court. Through the United Nations Security Council, we are studying it now, we will raise it in General Assembly. We will talk to heads of states at every forum, we will raise it in the media and tell the world.
For more on the protest march in Delhi, I spoke to our correspondent in the city, Rahul Tandon.
There was a lot of anger. People in that protest, many of them were young Kashmiris who for the last 3 or 4 days have not been able to contact their elderly parents, their families. The things that they said to me were normal things that people expect to do in their lives. And as you heard from one of the women there, she felt a sense of betrayal. And many of them, when I asked them, do you now feel more integrated with India? Because that is what the government says, removing Kashmir's autonomy will do. They quite quickly said no. In fact, they said they'd never felt further away from Delhi and from the people who rule them. The interesting thing on the opposite side of the street were supporters of the Indian government who were shouting, Kashmir Hamara Hai, Kashmir is ours, and shouting support of the action that has been taken. And that paradox, that street, reflects the problem here at the moment. On the one hand, you have the vast majority of this country who support the actions taken by the Indian Prime Minister. They say if Indian-administered Kashmir is part of this country, they should be able to buy land there. It should be treated as every other state has been in this country. On the other hand, you have the people of the valley, mainly Muslims, who feel disconnected now, not just physically, because there's no way for them to communicate, but also, I think, from their politicians in Delhi as well.
We've said that Kashmir is in lockdown. Do we know what's happening there? Has anything emerged?
We're getting drips and drabs of information that is being fed out. We have now these reports of some sort of protests that are taking place. But the general picture we're getting from the information that is coming through is of a state which is home to millions of people in complete lockdown. People staying within their homes. Cable television is shut off. The internet is shut down. Mobile phones and landlines are shut down as well. I mean, I've been speaking to Kashmiris who say they think that in some parts of the state, people don't even know that the autonomy has been withdrawn from them.
Rahul Tandon. A report by a US Defense Department watchdog has warned of a resurgence by Islamic State militants in Syria, months after Donald Trump declared the group to have been totally defeated. The Pentagon's Inspector General said the militants had been able to regroup as the US withdrew its forces. The agency said the jihadists were exploiting weaknesses in local forces in Syria and Iraq. Shama Khalil spoke to Patrick Coburn, Middle East correspondent for the Independent newspaper here in the UK and author of The Age of Jihad.
Islamic State was destroyed as a territorial entity which a few years ago stretched from Baghdad almost to the Mediterranean. So it is true that that was eliminated, but it was always likely that Islamic State would revert to guerrilla warfare, which it used to rely on before 2014. And this is a vast area. It's very difficult to occupy it effectively. So it's not too surprising that this happened. The report says there are 14,000 to 18,000 ISIS fighters and supporters in Iraq and Syria. So they have been re-establishing cells, launching ambushes, sniping, assassinations, but not trying to hold territory.
When they say they're resurging, because as you say, there's been guerrilla warfare for a while now since they've been declared defeated. I was in Iraq a couple of months ago, and the Kurdish fighters, the Peshmerga fighters say the problem with the fight now is that you're fighting an invisible enemy because there's no front line. So they're very much there. But when we talk about resurgence, are we talking about them claiming back territory or this guerrilla warfare being more intense?
I think we're talking about guerrilla warfare being more intense. Before they were defeated as a territorial entity, they had been saying that they would try to repeat what they did in the past. They suffered a big defeat in Iraq between about 2006 and 2009, and they went back to the great sort of deserts of western Iraq and hid out there. So they've probably prepositioned arms supplies. But I think there's another element that one has to look at, which is that they will have been waiting, ISIS will have been waiting for political disruption that they can take advantage of. And they're probably looking at greater confrontation, possibly even war between the US and Iran. That would be much to their advantage, particularly in Iraq. They're looking today at the possibility of a Turkish invasion of northeastern Syria, which President Erdogan of Turkey has said he's going to launch. This would disrupt the and totally preoccupy the Kurdish forces, which allied to the US had defeated ISIS in that zone. They're looking for these opportunities, which may come their way soon.
Patrick Coburn, Middle East correspondent for the Independent newspaper. Scientists in New Zealand say they've identified the fossilised remains of a giant parrot that stood 1 metre tall and had a huge beak. The announcement is based on the investigation of two bones found more than a decade ago among fossils dating back 19 million years. Rhianna Croxford has more details.
The paleontologists have named the parrot Heracles to reflect what they call its myth-like size and strength. The bird is said to have been the weight of a small dog. It's also twice the size of the largest living parrot, the critically endangered New Zealand kakapau. But unlike the Heracles of Greek legend, this creature was more likely to be feasting on its feathered friends than saving them. Researchers from Flinders University in Sydney say its massive beak could crack wide open anything it fancied.
Rhianna Croxford. And we'll have another bird story for you later. Also in this podcast...
I think it's hard to say how soon they will run out of water, but what the report finds is that there are 17 countries that face extremely high levels of water stress.
That's the finding of a new study out from the World Resources Institute, which says many countries affected are the most populated. China has said that while police in Hong Kong are able to handle protests as things stand, they are willing to send in the People's Liberation Army if they feel the need. It's the strongest warning yet, with a senior official saying the territory is facing its worst crisis since it returned to Chinese control in 1997. Meanwhile, hundreds of lawyers in the territory have been marching to call for an independent investigation into current events. Solicitor John Clancy is one of those taking part.
The march today is for two main reasons. The first is to have an independent inquiry into the causes of these events, to find out what is happening behind the scenes, independent of the government, independent of the police, to find out exactly what are all the causes, both remote and proximate and direct. Secondly, is that we want a very independent prosecution procedure.
It comes after 9 weeks of anti-government protests in Hong Kong, initially sparked by anger over a proposed new law that would make it easier to extradite people to the mainland. Our correspondent in Hong Kong is Danny Vincent, and he told me how he's interpreting the warning from Beijing.
In the past, it's sometimes been a little bit difficult to decipher exactly the meanings behind some of the comments made by top Beijing officials. But what we can say is the words that they're using, they're becoming increasingly stern, very direct and a lot more frank. A few weeks ago, or maybe months ago, when this protest movement originated, the idea that the People's Liberation Army could enter this semi-autonomous region was something that most Hong Kong people wouldn't even really consider. This city is an international financial hub. It has special freedoms and it also generates a lot of money for the rest of China and including some government officials. But it seems that things are changing very quickly here. We've seen so many protests in many different districts across the city. Violence and destruction is becoming a lot more common and the use of force from the police seems quite normal now.
And people from all walks of life really taking part in the protest. Lawyers today, for example.
That's right. The protest movement have tried to maintain the momentum by reaching out to different groups in society. Of course, thousands, according to organisers, of lawyers took to the streets today and they marched silently. They're arguing that they want an independent judicial system. They don't want this system to be changed. And there's accusations that the judicial system is maybe being used as somewhat of a tool by the authorities. This is the second march that we've seen lawyers take part in. This is really a rare occasion, but things like this are becoming increasingly common now in Hong Kong today.
Danny Vincent in Hong Kong. One of Australia's top spies has warned that leaks of classified information risk damaging the country's reputation. The Director General of National Intelligence, Nick Warner, made the rare public comments to a parliamentary inquiry into press freedom. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
Nick Warner said that if Australia couldn't be trusted to keep classified information secret, other countries wouldn't share it. He warned that leaks could cause grave damage. MPs in Canberra are investigating whether legal protections for journalists and whistleblowers had been weakened in favour of national security measures. In June, the police raided the ABC over stories of alleged misconduct by Australian troops in Afghanistan that were based on confidential military documents.
For Mercer in Australia. We're using too much water. That's the finding of a new study out from the World Resources Institute. So much, in fact, that 17 countries could run dry if something doesn't change. They include some of the world's most populous countries. So, how soon will these countries run out of water? Shamik Khalil spoke to Paul Rieg from the organisation.
I think it's hard to say how soon they will run out of water, but what the report finds is that there are 17 countries that face extremely high levels of water stress. And what that means is that on average, domestic, agricultural, and industrial water users within those countries are withdrawing around over 80% of the available supply on an annual basis. So the question about how soon they could run out of water really depends on two things. One is how quickly their demands might increase, right? Driven by growing demand for food, for energy, growing demands for industry and economic growth on the one side. And then on the other is any shortfalls in water supply. And that can be driven by a drought or by a low supply year driven by variability in precipitation. So it's hard to say exactly because there are multiple factors that could influence that.
And these two factors are actually happening everywhere in the world. I mean, there is more of us. There's going to be more of us. And it's raining less and getting hotter, you know, across the globe because of climate change. So are we then looking at a point where this is inescapable for some countries?
Yes. I mean, unfortunately, I think it's fair to say that for some countries, particularly those with extremely high levels of water stress, they're going to face a critical decision over the coming months or years in which they need to decide the urgency and the ambition of their water management plans and policies.
What countries are we talking about? Which ones are in most danger?
So the 17 countries that are ranked as extremely high water stress include 12 countries in the Middle East and North Africa. And then they also include two countries in Africa, two in Asia, and one in Europe. Of all of those, I think, you know, India stands out as the one with most population. Right. India faces severe levels of water stress that affects millions of people in both rural and urban areas.
And it's interesting, though, that India is on that list because, you know, one thinks of the monsoon rains and you think, well, you know, does it actually get dry? Are they going to run out of water? But your report seems to think so.
Yeah, I think what we're seeing in these results is that the demand is really high relative to the supply, and that in years when the monsoon isn't delivering the supply that's expected, like we're seeing this year in Chennai, it really leaves us as cities and regions extremely vulnerable.
Paul Rieg from the World Resources Institute. Now, if you've ever visited the British coast and its seaside towns, you'll have come across seagulls, large birds, so large they're almost intimidating. And when they're not screeching in the skies, they're earthbound in search of a snack. And if you're sitting on a bench or on the sand and look away briefly, seagulls will make off with your half-eaten sandwich, your French fry potatoes or chips. But they won't do that, scientists from the University of Exeter in southern England say, if you give the seagulls a good old-fashioned stare. We sent the BBC's intrepid reporter Sam Gruitt out to the seaside town of Brighton in southern England to put the new research to the test.
Hello. Could I have some chips, please? I'm on Brighton seafront and I thought I'd treat myself to a great British favourite. Chips. Could I have some Salt and vinegar as well? A little bit of salt, a little bit of vinegar, and a lot of ketchup. But if you let your guard down around here, you risk being ambushed. I'm going to see if a good old-fashioned stare-down will stop these seagulls from pinching my lunch. Hello there. Sorry if I'm bothering you. I can ask you a quick question. I see you're tucking into something rather tasty there.
Yeah, I was going to say, it's a bit awkward. I have my mouth full, but yeah.
I'm just wondering whether you've ever had an incident involving a seagull stealing some food from you.
Not from my hand, from the table, yeah.
From the table?
Yeah.
So you've managed to avoid being directly attacked by a seagull?
I do take precautions. Kind of make myself big, use both hands to eat the sandwich, for instance.
Because you're playing with fire a little bit here.
Exactly.
You've got a tasty-looking sandwich.
And you're distracting me from defending myself, that's true.
What are you eating?
A crab roll.
And do you think the seagulls normally go for that sort of thing?
They eat anything, don't they?
Chips? Am I safe with chips?
They'll eat the lot. They'll eat the bag.
Excuse me, sorry, you don't mind if I ask you a very quick question for BBC Radio? Have you ever had anything stolen from you by a seagull?
Yeah, chips. Chips and a hot dog.
From your hand?
Yeah, straight out of my hand.
I've got a box of chips in my hand right now, and I'm going to test out a new theory that staring at a seagull stops it stealing your food.
OK, let's do it.
Are we going to try it now, together?
Yeah.
OK, right, let's do it. Are you ready to stare down a seagull with me?
Yeah.
Right. The chips are on the ground. We're waiting now for gulls to see them and pounce. There are a few circling in the sky. Oh, I think one spotted us. Oh, no, they're starting to gather. Stare them out. Stand your ground. You know, I think we might have scared them off with that. Oh, we're standing our ground. They are starting to swoop a bit, though, aren't they? Oh, my God, they're swooping down. He really went for us then. We're under siege. I'm looking that one right in its beady eye,
it's
and it
working.
Doesn't want it.
It's working.
Right, I'm staring at him. He's creeping closer.
Stare.
Keep staring. Oh, no, they've got it. Oh, my God, they've attacked it. Now they're all going for it. There's quite a few of them now. They've just absolutely ravaged the box. How many do you think just swooped on us?
30. At least 30.
At least 30. That was quite terrifying.
Sam Gruitt, surrounded by seagulls in the seaside town of Brighton in southern England. And that's it from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered in it, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. I'm Valerie Sanderson. Until next time, bye-bye.